Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris Fax and our sponsor, Jump Desktop. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. I'm a working film, TV, and documentary editor. Over the last 9 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. Welcome to the final episode of Season 9. Don't worry, Season 10 starts next week. I've been using Boris Fax products for 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today on Art of the Cut, we're talking with BAFTA nominee Mark Everson about editing Wonka. Mark has edited both of the Paddington movies, Dora and the Lost City of Gold, and Johnny English Strikes Again, among other movies. His TV work includes Tracy Ullman's show, The Toast of London, and his BAFTA nomination for The Mighty Boosh. Before I hop into our discussion with Mark, a brief thank you to our sponsors. Jump Desktop is a high-performance and secure app that lets you virtually connect to your editing bay as if you were physically there. Keep all your assets in one place and connect to your powerful editing bays from anywhere. Jump Desktop's high-performance remote desktop protocol lets you edit from any low-powered laptop. With end-to-end encryption, native support for macOS and Windows, and multi-monitor support, you can be productive from anywhere. Jump Desktop also has collaborative screen sharing for collaboration with your team. See what thousands of editors have been using to get their work done from across the world. Visit jumpdesktop.com/cut to begin your free no-limits 14-day trial today. And to our partner, Boris FX. I've been using Boris FX and Sapphire for 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris FX is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris FX suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC. Why not read along? That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. And now, Mark Everson discusses editing Wonka.
Thanks for having me, by the way, Steve. You're a legend and you've spoken to all of the people I look up to, so it's a real honor to be talking to you.
Oh, thank you very much. Let's start out with just the idea of editing a musical. Do you find that it's different to edit where somebody can break into song at a moment's notice, or is it no different?
It's quite a heightened genre. But this is the second musical I've done. You know, it's great that I had the experience of doing one before. The big challenge is sort of feathering into those songs. I mean, it's quite a strange act, people going from drama into singing a song. You know, let's face it, it is a bit weird. And you don't want it to bump too much or sort of feel like a needle drop. You just want to feel it as organic as possible and sort of feathering into those songs and also out of them is a big part of it. But really, I mean, I think I found that the biggest challenge really is how songs affect the overall story arc and the pacing. You know, you've got to keep the story going and everything flowing and people interested. And with comedy, you know, you've got this extra plate spinning that you need to keep them laughing enough that they don't feel like you've switched off the comedy tap or, you know, it's turned into a different genre. But then when you've got songs as well, like, I mean, that's hard. Not all of the songs are comic. Some are just emotional. Some move the story on. Some don't as much. And you can play with the durations of songs, you know, which we did. And we've tried songs out and we've tried songs back in again. And we've tried to half songs. And we've tried all kinds of different sort of ways to modulate the songs to help the pacing of the film. And, you know, we've arrived at where we are, really. I used to be a documentary editor. So in documentaries, you used to do quite a lot of montaging. And that was the main thing I missed with going to scripted sort of comedy initially, is that you don't really often get to montage or cut stuff to music. So it was brilliant to be able to come back to that. So I don't think the challenge is sort of the songs per se. It's how they fit into the story and how they affect the pacing overall. We sort of played around with the songs quite a bit in the process.
I'm intrigued by what you were saying about feathering into and feathering out of the songs, because I totally understand that concept. It's like you said, how do you get from the drama to the singing and make it feel organic?
Well, Joby Talbot, our composer, did quite a lot of work that I think will be sort of subconscious to the audience, that he kind of feathered the themes into the songs before the songs kick in. So in a way, like, he's seeding the familiarity of it. But equally, like, you know, where does the song start? And it'll usually kind of start feathering in the dialogue. And you just don't want it to be, and here's the song. You've got to do a lot of building up to it, really. And I guess a lot of it is down to Joby, and he did a terrific job. And I mean, feathering in the themes beforehand so that the songs are familiar before you even hear the actual song. The Sweet Tooth theme that the Cartel have, you hear it through the Monks, and you hear it a lot before you actually have the song. So, yeah, I think a lot of it is down to Joby, which is absolute, you know, he's a genius. And, you know, and the thing is, we're working at such a high level where the songs are brilliant, the acting is brilliant, it's everything's great. You know, you haven't got the excuse of cutting things out because they're rubbish or they don't work or we all messed up. Nobody's messing up. You've just got to vibe it and feel the pace and just feel whether it's dropping or not and modulate as you see fit.
Near the end of the film, there's a song called Sorry Noodle, Noodle being the name of a heroine in the film. So could that song have been longer originally?
There's Sorry Noodle is, I think it's about a minute long, and it was a big back and forth with Willie and Noodle. Like, they were separate, but, you know, they would have their own parts of the songs. And the feeling was that it was just too downbeat for too long of that part of the movie. And we tried it out for a long time, and we've tried different lengths, and we sort of arrived at where we did. But it's very similar to other songs that you know, we sometimes tried them in half, we brought them all back again, and different computations, really, as we went through before we arrived at where we did.
Pacing a movie, when it's drama, you can cut a line, you can cut a look, right? But with music, you've at least got to get through the phrase, you've got to get through the chorus, yeah, or the verse or something. You're a little bit restricted in how much you could contract it and still have it make sense.
Jamie, which is the first musical I edited, which was a West End show. Growing up, I used to play drums in a kind of punk band, so it was not the most musical. But a word I learned on everyone's talk about Jamie is musically square. So, yeah, you can't just sort of cut half a phrase or, you know what I mean? It's got to be four bars and it's got to be musically square. It's got to be musical. So, yeah, you're right. You can't just cut where you want. You've got to have the musical shape, and you can't just have a verse without a chorus or, you know what I mean? There's some balance there, and there's kind of musical faux pas. So, yeah, you haven't got enormous flexibility. That's why you kind of end up having to sort of half a song, or you lose a middle eight, or you cut the song entirely. And, you know, we've tried all of these things in different places. Scrub Scrub has a reprise. So they all sing Scrub Scrub, and it's all about the mundanity of their manual work. And later on, Willie's kind of got a plan that he's going to change things. One of the overriding criticisms early on when we had all of the songs in full length was there's too many songs, there's too much music. I mean, the tough thing is, in the early stages, you haven't got all the drama scenes firing on all cylinders and in exactly the rhythm you want. So it's really hard. You're sort of refining the drama, and then you're also trying to judge the pace of these songs as you go. You're doing everything all at the same time, and it's really hard to tell. And the more you refine everything else, it informs all the other decisions. And I think one of the things we did with Scrub Scrub was we re-edited it to deconstruct it as a song. So Timmy or Willie used to sing the song with them, but we recut it so that he isn't taking part in the song, and the Wash House Gang are all, they're all singing it, and they're singing the backing vocals, and he's kind of derailing it. And of course, like with editing, the idea is you don't want it to look like, oh, that's a really brilliant reworking of what you had. It needs to look like that was the intention. You know, that's the challenge. And if it doesn't look like that, then you're back to the drawing board. So it took us days to get this concept of a deconstructed song. And it did take pickups in the end. And the magical kind of dog-powered washing machine was an addition in pickups. So also in Hatful of Dreams, there was a moment where there's a shop he wants. And in the original song, we just felt it hadn't nailed that. You know, it hadn't specifically said, that's the shop for me. That's my dream shop. I want that shop. It was a little bit softer and probably didn't hit the nail on the head. So we entered into creating a series of storyboards where we would do a pickup shoot and some head replacement on a pre-existing, already shot dance scene in the location that they've already smashed up and put in a skip somewhere. Paul is a fearless reimaginer, and if something isn't right, you know, we'll rip it out by the root and put storyboards in and reimagine it. And that was one of the moments I did think, well, we're rewriting a song that's already shot. There's been lots of work in changing the songs.
That's amazing. You mentioned the heightened nature of this movie and musicals in general. Was it something, especially with Wonka, Timothy's character, was it something that he gave you multiple tones, temperatures of performance so you could dial that in?
That's a very astute question. Yeah, we were blown away by Timmy's performance. I guess what he offered us was incredibly brave as an actor. He was throwing all kinds of attitudes and, like you say, temperatures at us, you know, that we had at our disposal. And he was very free at trying all kinds of things. What you often receive in the edit is an actor aiming towards a performance, and they slowly kind of get there. Whereas what Timmy gave us was different shades, different angles, different choices. So that was incredible to have, really. What some people misunderstand from the character Willy Wonka is he's not the same Gene Wilder character who's been betrayed, who's jaded and is trying to test these children. This was the Wonka before he's been twisted and betrayed. What Wonka made was wondrous, and it's not really the work of a cynic or the work of that gene, you know what I mean? I don't think you would have created the chocolate factory if he was that cynical character to begin with. So that's what we were aiming for with Timmy. But yeah, we were just blown away. There was a song that we cut that was reprised. There's a particularly sad moment where all is lost, basically.
Every movie's got that, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And there's about 14 takes of it. Each one, he gets sadder and sadder. Until about the last two or three, he's crying and he's singing this song, is tracking in, not to any music. He's just singing it. His voice is breaking all the way in, teardrops. And we ended up cutting the song, and it feels like absolute madness. And like I said earlier, you know, we're dealing with world class everything. Part of you saying, how can we cut that? It's insane. The most amazing performance. But we lost the song that it was reprising, and we probably didn't need that at that moment. But there was other cases of when he's welling up with tears that we have used, and to see him building to that moment.
One of the other interesting things about performance is the rhythm of the dialogue. The dialogue is a very specific kind of rhythm, especially in interchanges between people, the pacing of it. Can you talk about some of those? It's almost sung. I mean, it's spoken dialogue, but it has such a rhythm to it.
Pacing on the macro level is something that Paul and I work really hard at. And really, we find that the dialogue is a music of its own. I mean, particularly with Wonka, in a way, we just wanted the dialogue to dance. We knew that we had these songs. We knew we were going to have to service songs. And there's, you know, if you've got a song, the pace of that song is the pace of that song. And we knew we were going to end up with a movie that was nearing 2 hours. And I think we just paid particular attention to the dialogue scenes. And I mean, the same is true on Paddington. We don't really want there to be a frame more than there needs to be. You know, we loosen it off a frame and we feel like, oh, that's right. You're like, you can feel a frame. And I think the music of the comedy and the dialogue is, yeah, it took us a long while to get there. We do over tighten and then we do ease it off again. And I've worked with some directors who are very scared to see how far it can go. Whereas working with Paul, we push it quite often to the point where it breaks and then ease it back again. But yeah, I'm particularly pleased with the sort of fluidity of the rhythms of the dialogue. And it is a heightened rhythm. It's not the rhythm that it was ever performed. For starters, you'd be overlapping on some occasions. but it's a rhythm that I think feels natural for the film. It's like a heightened comic rhythm to dialogue. The challenge is to still make it feel natural in a heightened sense, if that even makes sense.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I noticed some great transitions. You used some wipes in there. Talk to me about making those decisions. They certainly feel natural to the film. The choice to do the wipe instead of a dissolve or instead of a simple cut.
I mean, I always wanted to get a clock wipe in there, but we never really, it never felt right. You come up with them in one place and then you feel like, oh, well, you can't just have it in a couple of places. You've got to run with it and find some more places to have it. Just going back to the comic rhythms for a second, some of the jokes we have verge on your sort of cartoony jokes. Certainly when Wonka gives the Oompa Loompa at the end his chocolates back, like that's a cartoon rhythm. And sometimes we verge into that. You know, and I think we get it from those sort of Warner Brothers, Looney Tunes animations, you know, those rhythms. And I think growing up with those is certainly where I guess me and Paul go into that at times. But the transitions, I think there's a point where Noodle gives Basil a sweet and puts it down. And then we line the shots up in the sweet in this little circle wipe. And I think that was sort of the first. And then you just sort of extrapolate them from there. I don't know. I think there's something a bit timeless about Wonka, a bit 1930s-y. I think there's a kind of classic feel to it. And those shape wipes just felt quite good. And certainly in the musical numbers, they felt really nice. And I'm a bit of a shape wipe addict. I think we ended Paddington 2 with a little circle on Felix Buchanan. And I've done it. I'm a bit of a sucker, but yeah, I think it's weirdly those early Warner Brothers cartoons that maybe I got it from, and maybe the Muppet Show.
Muppet Show for sure. While we're kind of thinking along those same lines, talk to me about the animation that's in the movie, which is limited, but it's there and important. Did you have that stuff as you were cutting? Did you have to kind of imagine it?
So Paul is a fearless and constant reimaginer and is always thinking about how to perfect the film. Even in the mix where you can't do anything, Paul will turn to me and say, do you know what we should have done? Do you know what I mean? And I'm like in the mix, just, you know, all I can think about is what we've done and where we are. But Paul will be reanalyzing the whole process in his head. What would I have done again? What were our mistakes? What would I rewrite? But all the way through, Paul is always thinking of new ideas and putting them in. New jokes, anything we can rewrite, any bits of ADR. So the whole idea of this sort of animation came in the visual effects reviews. Everything's on my Framestore, and the giraffe, unfortunately, isn't real, but looks incredible. So that was come up with during the visual effects review. And then we reprised that idea at the end. There's a whole sort of blueprint idea of basically Abacus Crunch, who's one of the Wash House gang, tells Willy all he needs to know about the security involved in breaking into the cartel's chocolate supply. They shot the flashback sequence and he's going through and he's finding blueprints, and Paul had this idea. He can open it up and we can zoom in and this animation will play out. One of the big challenges, apart from all of the songs, was the fact that we've got lots of characters that all have backstory. Timmy is arriving as a fresh character, you know, which is a classic storytelling trick because we experience it through them. They're new in town. We don't know anything and people can tell them information and it doesn't sound like terrible, clunky exposition. He's a character who's arriving with a backstory and ambitions that need to be conveyed. Everybody's got their own backstories. And also on top of the world that needs explaining. That was one of the big challenges, was I think when we do have some backstory, that it's exactly what we need and no more and no less, and that we do it in an interesting way. So the blueprint was something we came up with later just to make this backstory a bit more fun and palatable and to be able to show everybody what they need to know. They all came as afterthoughts, really. And we did think about having another animation somewhere else.
You mentioned the giraffe, which is beautifully done. Talk to me about all of the VFX, because I'm sure the giraffe was not the only VFX shot in the movie. How do you deal with editing those scenes where there's no giraffe? What do you have at your disposal to help you figure out the pacing and the timing and what it's going to look like?
Well, our imagination more than anything, because we did the Paddingtons. You know, an actor brings an entire performance that you end up bouncing on, whether that's just whether they flick their eyes or the expression or everything an actor does, you bounce off as an editor. You know, they give you your in point, your out point, and absolutely everything. So you end up in these conversations that with, oh, okay, we'll cut to the giraffe. Oh, I tell you what that should do to bring our eye to there is lick this, or it should shake it. You know, you're discussing what the performance should be, because you can ask for that performance from Framestore. And they were all the conversations we had on Paddington. Paddington could do a lot more than a giraffe, because a giraffe had to feel real. But yeah, they were the conversations we were having. And to be honest, with pacing, and it's the same with Paddington, you're completely guessing, and it's possible to guess without rushes. As Framestore gives you more and more, the performance comes to life and you slowly realize, you know, you can get things terribly wrong, and you gave them a 3-second plate and you might need six, or vice versa, and you feel it slowly develop. The challenge is with the visual effects side, you end up having to re-edit every iteration, and it concertinas up and down and slowly comes together over months until you get this seamless performance. The other big visual effect is the Oompa Loompa with Hugh Grant. People will think it's motion capture, but it's not motion capture. And Hugh never had a green hair or orange skin, or ever wore a costume. It was, we just had video reference. And in a similar way from Ben Whishaw on Paddington, the visual effects team would like us just to choose one take of a line, but we get a bit naughty and decide, well, we like the first half of that take and the second half of that take. Or guess what? We like the first half of that take, the second half of that take audio wise, but the face that he pulled on the second half of that take from this other one, we would like that. I think Framestore started off saying, well, that was impossible, and ended up working out how it was done. The Oompa Loompa is very similar technology to Paddington, in the sense it's a kind of a digital maquette animated by an enormous team of animators. And it's not just Hugh's performances digitally transferred onto it. So you have lots of visual effects meetings, and you look back at his performance and see whether that really is coming through. And it's incredibly, incredibly painstaking. I don't even know how they do it. It's crazy. They develop over months and months at Framestore, and getting the timing, and you have to sort of modulate the edit. But it wasn't too challenging. Paddington was. Having that in every scene basically is really, really difficult, because every time Framestore deliver a new set of animation, just the rhythm changes. So normally as an editor, you go home and come in the next day and you've got the same film. But with Paddington, you go home, come in the next day, oh, there's a whole load of new visual effects been delivered and cut in. And you, like, suddenly the rhythm doesn't work. You have to recut every single time, which, yeah, can drive you mad. But it's endless, and every scene is at least 3 months in the development. Hopefully it works well in the end. The other aspects were the set extension. So Nathan Crowley built one of the biggest sets I've ever seen, and they really built that town square. And then off the town square comes the Gallery Gourmet, and they really built that. All that wasn't real was the ceiling when you tilt up. But it was a colossal set, and it was 2 stories high, and you could even get extras in the second story, like in a restaurant. You can see people eating up there. But everything above that is extended. The challenge with it is, really, is that it impacts on your schedule and your process and your the way you work, and you can't help but feel it ends up as the tail wagging the dog. Because you get this delivery schedule that dictates, hey, you really need to turn over this scene. And obviously myself and Paul will be thinking, well, that's not the scene we need to crack now, really. There's other things that have more knock on, but you end up having to just do what the visual effects department require, because you know, you'll find, hey, the lead on this is 8 months. We need to get animating this, get it turned. So you end up concentrating on things that you wouldn't necessarily concentrate on. I mean, there were quite a few pickups. There's certainly the finale of the film was a pickup. And I think we would have been asked to turn that as one of the very first scenes we turned, if we'd have known. But it was one of the last things we turned. And I couldn't believe Framestore managed to get it finished.
I always notice pre-lapse and post-lapse. And there's a lovely post-lap, which is relatively rare. Lots of people pre-lap going into the Sorry Noodle song. The cartel's giving him his ultimatum. The cartel continues to talk to him as you're seeing him walk away from the cartel.
Yeah, because normally me and my wife play the spot the ADR game when watching films. That's... And you know where there's key dialogue off camera? Oh, yeah. ADR. And actually, that wasn't ADR. That was in the script. I think it's there's a boat leaving at midnight. Be on that boat, and I can't, you know, whatever it was.
I didn't think it was ADR, but I just noticed that it was a pre-lap and or a post-lap, and I thought maybe you were pulling up time a little bit, or just to keep it interesting, or...
One of the things that Paul and I really concentrate heavily on is just questioning absolutely every bit of air and every frame, really. If we can economize and it still has the impact, then we'll do it. So it just felt right to push it under that shot. And also it had a long lead time, it had the space for it, and it just felt right. But yeah, I mean, we're always looking to what's the optimal pace here. And you know, we're always trying things. Like I said, with the songs, you know, we've tried lots of different combinations before we arrived where we did. In the drama scenes also, we'll try things in, we'll try things out. We'll push the pace till it breaks and then ease it back off again. And even in the mix, there's a really good joke that I'm really pleased we put back. When Larry, the bad comedian, leaves, Bleacher, who's one of the baddie, tells him that he's a big fan of his comedy, basically. Literally, we were in the mix and me and Paul missed a joke there. So we went back into the cutting room and put it back in. So, I mean, it's literally till the last. I mean, we drive everyone insane. I think the idea is normally that you go to the mix, picture's locked, and that's it. That's not really how we roll.
I have interviewed plenty of editors that talk about making editing changes in the mix. You're in the mix and somebody's like, grab your laptop and, you know, we're going to stick this shot back in. We're putting the scene back in.
One of the big challenges was all the backstories of all the characters and all of the exposition. We used to open with a whole prologue of young Willie and Sally Hawkins's mum. So we opened with a whole scene on the boat and it was lovely and really warm and really, you know, a beautiful scene. It set them up. And then we went to Willie as he is now. And then also when Willie ends up in the wash house, he has this scene with Noodle and there's a little flashback in the middle of there. And that used to have a song that told us a bit more about what happened to his mum and his youth and the kind of this sort of a heart-wrenching story. And the feeling was with the prologue, certainly from the studio, they felt, well, why, you know, I think we're best off starting with Wonka now. The strange thing that happened with having quite a serious prologue with no jokes is that people started laughing a lot later, because I think it set the wrong tone for the film. Like, it didn't set out our stall, which is this is a heightened, essentially feel-good comedy. Although it was a beautiful scene, it was probably gave... It felt slow, even though, you know, I don't think it was slow, but I think it was the accumulative effect was it slowed the film down. So we actually combined that with some of the backstory stuff. We got rid of the song because it felt like there were too many songs. It was a bit sad. And we kind of combined those two things together to make something else.
On a kind of a dramedy where you're not quite sure whether you're watching a comedy. This isn't the instance for Wonka, but where you're not quite sure you're watching a comedy or a drama. You want to give people permission to laugh early in the movie so they know. Because otherwise, if you have a long period of drama and then something funny happens, they're like, I'm not sure. Is that supposed to be funny? You're right. But if you put it at the beginning, then they're like, oh, okay, there's funny stuff that's going to happen throughout the whole movie and sad stuff. And I'm good to do
well, we had,
any emotion.
On Paddington 2, there's a barbershop scene that I think is terrific. And it's just basically, you know, Clumsy Bear is mistaken as a barber and ruins the grumpy old man's hair. And, you know, it occurred to us that, well, you know, what's this doing narratively, you know, in the first 10 minutes of the movie? But so you have to interrogate it and you have all kinds of, you know, conversations to justify things. And, you know, it arose, oh, well, I guess it's not that nutritious in story terms. And, you know, there's an argument that in the first 10 minutes of your film, everything should be story, 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 and paying off at the end. And we tried it out, you know, we tried to cut it. What quite often happens when you cut things is it informs you actually what they do that isn't really as evident. you know, you sometimes can't put your finger on while it's in. It takes cutting it to actually show you what you're missing. And it set the stall out for the film. You know, it said, this is a comedy, this is the tone. You know, it's one of those things where you don't necessarily feel like, oh, you know, I don't think in those script writing books they say, hey, you really need to set the tone early on. You know what I mean? It's normally set the characters up, set the plot, you know, all of this kind of stuff. And it really just set the tone up and it got people laughing early. And it gives them permission to start laughing. And I think that's really important with the comedy. That was one of the main problems with the prologue, was you just need a laugh early on. And it was just a nicer way to start the movie.
I love the idea of, I call it a slash and burn cut, where you do cut things out that you think that you need or might be impossible to have the movie without, but you cut them and then you do realize this other thing that we didn't think could go can go, but this thing cannot go. And you don't realize those until they're gone.
Working with Paul, he likes to try things out. I do as well. I think it's very freeing because you just, you know, they can come back. And you often learn why you miss them. And sometimes you learn what about that scene you don't miss. And maybe you can cut some of that. So, you know what I mean? Everything informs the decision-making process. We experiment with all kinds of cuts. And, you know, and it's quite tough at times because you're watching the film back and you'll, hey, this time we're trying that bit of the song out. We put that back in. This joke is out. You know, and how that affects the whole is quite you know, it's sometimes quite hard to tell, but you slowly build up a picture of what needs to be in by these different combinations. And I guess, yeah, it's like trying to break the combination lock of what the content of the movie is going to be. And like I said, even at the last minute, we're suddenly having regrets and putting things back in again. I don't think there's anything I regret cutting. In a weird way, there's a couple of things I'd probably still cut from Wonka, but they're literally like 2 seconds here and 2 seconds there. But the thing is, when you're sort of dragged kicking and screaming away from something, and when it's been your job for 20 months to focus on what's wrong with something, because that's the job, and it can sound quite negative. We're so forensic and meticulous that by the time the film's finished, you don't necessarily walk away feeling like this is a triumph. When you solve something, you don't like have a little party and all slap each other on the back. When you solve something, and you know, even with all kinds of outside notes, you know, the note just stops coming. You know, there's no, well done, we cracked that. It's just the note, you just forget that and you move on to the next problem. So you've spent a year or 2 years moving on to the next problem and you just get to the end and think, oh God, did we solve them all? Was that good enough? And there was a few things that we never quite solved. Oh, you know, is this actually any good? And then when an audience starts to watch it and basically like it, in a way you only ever feel like you've got away with it. I don't want to sound sort of morose, but you know, your mindset is to not be too self-congratulatory. You don't really end up slapping yourself on the back at any point. It's just onto the next problem. What now needs to be made better? And it's you know, it can kind of feel endless, but it never, like on the Paddingtons, I don't think it ever occurred to us that they were any, certainly Paddington 1, it was just problem to problem, you know, a year of trying to solve, you know, hone it and just find what is the problem, what's the problem, you know, what's now is what, how do we need to focus on, what needs to be made better, what's suboptimal, you know, so you're only ever seeking what is imperfect and trying to make it perfect. And then moving on. So yeah, like certainly in the end of Paddington 1, it never occurred to us that it was any good. And with Paddington 2, I think, I don't know what we thought, you just sort of get spat at the end and people start watching it.
And loving it.
With Wonka, again, you know, you sort of have your perceived flaws that you're trying to improve. And you just get to a point where you think, well, that's the best solution we've come up with. I wonder whether that's good enough. And then when people watch it and enjoy it, it's a big relief.
That goes along with the old saw about no movie is ever finished, it's just abandoned, right? Like if you thought it was perfect, you'd send it off to the mixer and you'd be done. But nobody ever thinks their movie is perfect. You're all, what else could we do? What else could we interrogate to get this thing?
Yeah.
Now talk to me a little bit about your process of looking at the dailies and constructing a scene. A lot of the scenes have really beautifully directed and camera movements that are specialty shots, where you go like, as an editor, at least I'm watching like, well, of course you start on this, you know, amazing camera movement. That's you couldn't start anything else, kind of. Talk to me about the choices of finding those things when you get out of a shot like that, or maybe just saying, hey, there is a great specialized shot like that, but I'm going to start on a simple close-up because it doesn't fulfill my story purpose or whatever it is.
Because you've got to stay up to date with the crew to a certain extent, and I mean, there's always a bit of a pipeline for the rushes to get through, so you're always a little bit behind, but because you want to be in touch with the team and tell them what pickups you might need or what you think is missing, there's always a pressure, really. So the early assemblies are pretty, you know, they're what you can get done in the time. And there are quite a lot of speciality shots, and there are sequences like the hover chops where everybody flies. So there's quite a lot of speciality shots there, people on wires and these kind of aerial shots twisting around. I mean, it could have been a very, very long sequence. And we did have an assembly where it was really long. Paul is always keen to leave people wanting more. So we didn't really go as far as we could have with that, which I think was the right thing in the end, because you really want, as soon as it's starting, the police comes in and completely stops everything and kiboshes it. I don't think you want to be showboating for too long. We did have some quite long tracking shots. I mean, we really, really so keen on the pace that we do, even the sort of speciality shots, we try and cut into them. There's one of the speciality shots where we track around his room that Mr. Scrubbit's taking him to. And originally we tracked up some stairs and we went quite far before we found Noodle, and she puts Noodle in the coop. But we just felt it was too long. So we ended up putting a CG door in and cheating her. So the first door she goes through wasn't necessarily the door that took her to that corridor. She went up some stairs, there was a bit more dialogue. And, you know, like I said, we're really keen on sort of eliminating any shoe leather that we don't really need. So as she comes through the first door, Framestore put this door opening in over her that she's not actually pushing, so that we could sort of foreshorten it, really. Yeah, I mean, even with these sort of sweeping speciality shots, we're always got an eye on the pace, really, and just getting really exactly what we need in, not just letting the shot really dictate the pace of the movie.
You had some really big tonal shifts. I thought, you know, you've got funny things, you've got heartfelt things and sad things and dramatic, you know, the characters are in a bad spot kind of thing. You never want to be in any of those places too long, right? Talk to me about the work you did to keep tonal sections the right length.
I guess one of the big tonal shifts is the sad part and the down part. And we were really sensitive to how long that went on. I mean, you've got the scene where the chocolatiers come into the shop. Like I said, we cut a song there. So a song had already gone. We had Sorry Noodle, you know, is the sad I'm leaving you song. That's very sad. And it had a number of verses. It had Willie had a verse, and then Noodle had her bit, and then Timmy sort of finished it off. So it was a full rounded song. And what's in at the moment is, you know, really just the start of it. And we tried it with, you know, 2/3 of it. We tried it out. It was out for a long time because it lifts. You just go, get on that boat. He's meeting them on the jetty. And you know, that sort of overlap that we talked about earlier, you know, that was just on him coming down the jetty, and it still works. And it's, I've got a ticket for a one-way ticket. Because, you know, we've carved ourselves out as a musical, and that's the movie we're making. It feels like, well, you know, why haven't you got a song for this ultimate sad beat? So we came up with the idea of just having this, you know, what's the shortest it could be, basically. And it's a minute, and it's just Timmy's side of it, and it's him packing up, and you see his mum in the case, and then you see him leaving. And in the longer version, Noodle sees him out the window, and she has her whole reply, and, you know, and it was beautiful, and she walks past his room, and it was great. But we feel like there's a double downbeat. You know, you've got the downbeat in the shop, he's bereft, he's been told to go, and you don't want 3 minutes of more down followed by the jetty, which is, you know, we just thought this is a real dip. And that's where we ended up, really, you know, after a lot of deliberation and trying different things. You know, we're very sort of sensitive to those tone shifts, really. And I hope we got them right.
But that was my point, is that even though you have great things in a section, in a certain tonal section, you've got to go, how long can this tonal section be here? Whether it's funny or sad or whatever it is, it can only be so long, and then you've got to come up with solutions. Tell me about Roald Dahl. Did you read the original book?
Do you know what? My relationship with the book, apart from reading it to my son, really, my overriding memory is just it used to be on television every Easter holiday in England. And really, it's just watching it again and again with through every Easter holiday, really.
Sounds like there's a lot of writing that goes on in the editing room.
I think working with Paul, the edit suite becomes an extension of the writing room more than with any other director, because he is the writer. He's got a very sort of root and branch approach to any problems, is remove it, let's come up with some storyboards, let's write what we really would like to pitch as a pickup. What's happened, you know, on both the Paddington films and this one, is we reached this point where there's quite a few proposed pickups, and Paul's a kind of master of these tiny pickups throughout the film that just keep things back on track, or, you know, economize or boost the emotion or the help the flow. And sometimes the pickups are just, you know, one headshot of, you know, Mr. Gruber saying a line, or from one line inserted to a whole scene rewritten. There's a scene where you've had the ultimate down and then Timmy, Willie returns. There was a scene there that was actually three different scenes to do basically the same job. And we rewrote it into one scene that basically did everything. And it just felt like, oh, it's just too long before we're sort of propelled into act three. We just need one thing to do it all. So like we have loads of these little things throughout, and it becomes quite a hard watch. We even have test screenings with these storyboards, with temporary dialogue, sometimes recorded by our actors on their phone, sometimes not. You know, and it's really hard for everybody to watch, and the audience always gets bumped out. You can feel it in the room, but we're trying to watch it as experts, trying to make a judgment call on it. And even you know, with us, it's really hard to judge because it isn't a finished scene. But yeah, Paul's a fearless reimaginer. So we always change a lot in every movie. There's the whole sort of heist aspect towards the end. There was another element, which was that there's a code to the safe and the cartel have the numbers that change every day. And there was this whole sequence as how they're going to extract them. I mean, one of the downsides was that Timmy had to explain this information before we then executed it. And it came up in a few screenings that people suggested, oh, could that not just lift? And so we removed it and simplified that whole last part of the film. We had the scene where the giraffe comes through the church and Father Rowan Atkinson's character is running away from it. And we kind of felt like the stakes hadn't been set up enough. We needed a scene to set up what their day was going to be in order for it to be ruined. So we had a pickup in there just to invest in Father Julius and their day and the evil chocoholic monks, just so that when their day was ruined, you know, you at least set it up. So yeah, that all was simplified. We used to have a scene where Pure Imagination was sung by a different character in a different part of the film. And again, that was one of those difficult things where it didn't really service the story. And it was like, we can remove this. And it was a really difficult decision because it was a really nice animated sequence and had loads of visual effects. At that point in the movie, it felt like you wanted more a plot and not an aside. It was one of those things that was sort of tipping us over the edge. So we removed it, gave Timmy the song at the end. We also had this problem that the end wasn't joyous enough because we had a song at the end that was very melancholy. And the tone of it is, you know, you're leaving and I'm going to miss you, but that's the best thing for you. And, you know, it's very melancholy. And essentially you ended the film. Like it was beautiful. Like it's a beautiful song, but you just wanted something that was going to make you punch the sky and go, yes. So we moved the song to the end. Everybody loved the Oompa Loompa, although we only really knew that right at the end, because they're watching this animation where the lips aren't moving and, you know, audiences can't really react to that. You're test screening these various stages of Oompa Loompa, and you've really got to have faith that it's going to be funny. And the finished product, they absolutely love, but you have to sit through these screenings where the animation isn't finished and they just can't laugh because they're just thinking, what the hell's this? So anyway, we rewrote the ending. In the original, it was a bit more of a Casablanca, you know, walking off into the sunset. But instead of walking off into the sunset, we walk with them. But, you know, we have this amazing end where we see what the chocolate factory might be. And it sort of takes us right up into the movie we know in a way, and ends the film really, really happily. The film did change a lot over the course of the edit. And like I said, yeah, Paul's a fearless reimaginer and rewriter. And a lot of the conversations in the cutting room are, what should this scene be? Not editing what we have, but editing what we want to be shot.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for joining me on Art of the Cut. It was a pleasure learning about this movie. And wow, as you said, a fearless reimagining.
Yes.
At all points.
Yeah, exactly. It's great when people, you know, like the end product. It's really, really rewarding.
Well, the audience I was in certainly appreciated it. So congratulations.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. And thanks for having me. It's been great talking to you, and an honor for me. Thank you.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors for a topic-driven, curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to Mark Everson for joining us on Art of the Cut. And thanks to our partner, BorisFX, and to our sponsor, Jump Desktop. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com and jumpdesktop.com/cut. I'm Steve Holmfish, ACE. Thanks for listening. And please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app.